From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the fine against Wynn Resorts, a verdict in the Insys pharmaceutical case, and President Trump weighs in on two local DAs suing federal immigration enforcement.
I think that it's a sad situation and very unfortunate for Massachusetts, a great place that I know very well, so many friends up there. And, you know, these are people that probably don't mind crime.
It's all part of our Week in Review. Also today, we'll remember the life of filmmaker John Singleton, whose work changed the landscape of movies forever.
Either they don't know, don't show, or don't care about what's going on in the hood.
And we'll talk to the first Democrat to officially throw his hat into the ring for 2020.
Well, I think I'm the right person for the job and I have the right vision for the country, but not enough people know who I am. So that's why I had to declare early.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Kimberly Atkins. It's Friday, which means Week in Review, beginning with a major verdict in Boston federal court. John Kapoor, the one-time billionaire and founder of Insys Therapeutics, and other top executives were found guilty by a jury yesterday on charges of racketeering. They could face 20 years behind bars. Prosecutors accused them of bribing doctors across the U.S. to prescribe a highly addictive fentanyl spray. U.S. District Attorney Andrew Lelling is calling it, quote, the first successful prosecution of top pharmaceutical executives for crimes related to the illicit marketing and prescribing of opioids. Michael Canty, himself a former prosecutor, tells CBS the verdict sends a powerful message.
This case had very good evidence. I think that this will send a message to other prosecutors that, look, these are cases that can be brought. And if you have the evidence and you can put it before a jury, there's hope that you can get you hold those criminally responsible.
Aaron Leibowitz, an analyst for Law 360, agrees.
I think the fact that they were able to win a conviction in this case, and not only a conviction, but on a serious charge of racketeering conspiracy, suggests that there could be more of these types of cases being tried.
Andrew Kolodny, co-director of opioid policy research at Brandeis University, says doctors should also be punished.
I'm not saying that we need to throw all of the doctors in jail who took these bribes, but I do think that medical boards should take action against these doctors. I can't think of anything more unethical than accepting a bribe from a drug company to prescribe a dangerous and addictive drug.
Sentencing dates have not been set yet, and Kapoor's attorneys say they'll continue to fight. But what are the implications of this verdict? Let's turn to our Week in Review panelists. Renee Loth is a columnist for the Boston Globe and a contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinion page. Welcome back, Renee.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Also with us is Jennifer Nassour, a former chair of the Massachusetts GOP and CEO of Reflect US. Welcome back to you as well.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So we'll start with you, Jennifer. What is your initial reaction to this verdict?
Oh, you know, I mean, good. I'm glad. And actually, I don't think it's long enough. And I mean, you know, this is criminal behavior. They're trying to get people hooked on drugs. And as someone who had a sibling who died as a result of a drug overdose, I think put them away for life because they're ripping away the lives of our kids, our brothers, our sisters, our parents, you know, and I think that there is just nothing to make any family feel better about their actions.
Renee, what do you think?
Yeah, I think this is an important reminder that corporate crimes are not necessarily victimless crimes. I mean, there are something like, I don't know, almost 1,000 people dying every week from these opioid abuses. And, you know, that's more than people who are dying in car accidents. But we learned in this case that these were not accidents, that defendants knew that the drugs were addictive. They knowingly paid millions of bribes and kickbacks to these doctors and others to get them to prescribe these, you know, deadly drugs. And, you know, I think it's appropriate to go after individuals in this case.
You know, one of the crucial pieces of evidence in this trial, which lasted 10 weeks, was a rap video that was created by the company in 1995 for a sales conference. in 2015, in a for a sales conference. In the video, two salesmen promote the use of fentanyl sprays, Subsys, and its dosage process known as titration. It even featured the company's vice president of marketing, Alec Berlikoff, dancing around in a Subsys costume. Let's listen to a bit of that video. I love titrations, yeah, that's not a problem. And I got new patients and I got a lot of them. If you want to be great, listen to my voice. You can be great, but it's your choice. Insys Therapeutics, that is our name. We're raising the bar and we're changing the game. To be great, it takes a decision to be better than the competition. Right. VIP service like they never seen. Build relationships that are healthy. Got more docs than Janelle's got selfies. So we're talking 2015 when the opioid crisis was pretty well known. This feels like a pretty cavalier attitude for these executives to have, Jennifer.
Yeah, I mean, it's cavalier. It's arrogant. It's malicious. It's willful intent. I mean, the whole thing, everything that they're doing, it is so disgraceful and so their words cannot describe. Again, I mean, as a anyone who's ever been on a board, your responsibility, you have a fiduciary responsibility to what you're on the board for, but also to the people that you serve. And I mean, I think that if you look at the board members, if you look at the corporate actions, the fact that they thought that putting out a rap video and doing that for a conference was something that would help their purpose, knowing what Oxy and what the drugs were doing, right. It just despicable.
And another piece of evidence was the testimony of two former Insys sales reps that say they saw one of the other defendants in this case, Sunrise Lee, a former stripper who served as a regional director at Insys, perform a lap dance for a doctor. Now, it's worth saying that in a statement to CBS News, Insys says this: the actions of a select few former employees are not indicative of the hard work conducted by our talented team today. Renee, how does that explanation fly for you?
Oh, well, you know, I love that line in the rap video that you played about building healthy relationships. You know, oh, my gosh, how many ways is that video wrong? You know, I think it's important to also recognize that this is, in my opinion, a far better outcome than most of what we're seeing in these cases where states have been bringing charges against corporate entities for, you know, their role in the opioid crisis. And most of these are ending in settlements. They're hush-hush settlements. You know, there's some, multi-million dollar fees or fines that are accounting errors for these companies.
Right.
And you never get to the disclosure, the discovery, and the kind of fact-finding that we saw in this case about how these corporations operate when you have these settlements. So I think this is a far better outcome than that.
And you're speaking of other actions. Attorneys general from Massachusetts and New York brought a suit last month against the Sackler family, which has controlled Purdue Pharma, the company behind the painkiller OxyContin. The filings argue that the family pushed aggressively to expand the OxyContin market for years after they knew it was highly addictive. Jennifer, what do you think that this Insys verdict means for the Sackler family for other actions like this?
Hopefully it means they should get prepared to go to jail for a long time and have their money stripped from them. I mean, they're, again, profiting off of people's lives, profiting off of destroying families. And I think that, you know, they have been living the high life and they can say that they've been giving money away to great causes. But, you know, if I was, MoMA or, any of the Louvre and I have, exhibits due to their money,
yeah,
I would probably want to get rid of those exhibits because that's drug money.
Yeah. Let's move on to another story involving law enforcement. Middlesex County District Attorney Marion Ryan and Suffolk County DA Rachel Rawlins filed a lawsuit earlier this week against U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, known as ICE, seeking to block the federal immigration authorities from making arrests in and around Massachusetts courthouses. DA Ryan says the threat of arrest means immigrants are being denied their right to appear in court.
Witnesses who may have seen something happen to any one of us or a member of our families are forced to choose between the protection of themselves and their family and their civic duty to come forward.
And D.A. Rollins told us on Radio Boston this week they're trying to protect victims of crime.
I have an obligation to victims. We have child rapists that were removed prior to a victim being told this information. And who do you think has to tell those victims that they no longer have their day in court and the defendant's gone? It's not ICE. It's the DA's office.
But President Trump, in a phone call to Boston Herald Radio, didn't see it that way.
I think that it's a sad situation and very unfortunate for Massachusetts, a great place that I know very well, so many friends up there. And, you know, these are people that probably don't mind crime.
Renee, what do you think about all this?
You know, I think that the DAs are right to sue. I think this case raises real questions about the federalism, you know, the relationship between the federal government and the states. In my opinion, I think this U.S. attorney going after the judge in this case is a kind of an overreach and an incursion into the state's operation of the state courts by the federal government. You know, it's a complicated case, and there's a lot of aspects to it, but the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts had issued a ruling in 2017, a lot of people forget this, saying that detaining non-citizens who would otherwise have been free to go in a court case because of an ICE detainer was out there for them was illegal, was not to be done. So, you know, maybe the judge, who was relatively new in her job, was, you know, believing that she was following that Supreme Judicial Court order, which is a Massachusetts order, not a federal order. And so we have a conflict here between federal and state jurisdiction. And I think that if nothing else, the case may clarify that.
And it comes right on the heels of last week when U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling's office indicted Judge Shelley Joseph and a former court officer for obstruction of justice, saying that they allowed someone to slip out of the back door of the courthouse. Rollins told us that this lawsuit was not spurred by this action, but Bristol County Sheriff Thomas Hodgson told WBUR he believes that their lawsuit is politically motivated.
I would challenge them to come forward and show us any witnesses that were arrested by going forward as a witness who were simply here for immigration overstay or simple violation. That's just not true. And they can't point to the cases, and that's why they won't.
Jennifer, what do you think of the politics of this?
I think there are politics, you know, and I think there are politics in everything. I do believe that there is a separation between the federal government and the state government. And I understand what the DAs are saying, but I understand also what the sheriff is saying. And both make sense. And I agree with Renee. I think that maybe this coming to a case and there being a lawsuit is probably the best way to settle the law and figure out what is going to be right going forward. Because, I mean, there are people who are here. If you're here illegally and you commit a crime, then, you know, you should be turned over at some point to ICE. But to prohibit, as the DA said, you know, a child of a rape or, you know, some sort of anyone, right, who has been criminally affected as a victim, and then the person who victimized them gets hauled off and they never have their day in court, that is not fair to the victims. And so, I mean, I think that there has to be some middle ground here that they can figure out and settle the law on.
Right. Now, I mean, not to mention other kinds of victims, like, for example, of domestic violence who are afraid to bring a case against or to look for a restraining order or anything like that, because as soon as I walk into that courthouse door, I or my family members or others who may be with me are vulnerable to being picked up by ICE. It's just not right. The courts in Massachusetts ought to be able to do their business, you know, in a safe way for all of the people who are involved in the judicial system. And ICE can do its own job without the help of the state courts, in my view.
President Trump, in that call to Boston Herald Radio, he wondered why Rollins and Ryan are doing this. And he said the people that ICE is looking for are dangerous.
They come from a place that you just can't really understand. They're coming from a you know, you almost wonder why. What are they doing? They're protecting people that in many cases are, and certainly not in all cases, but in many cases are very dangerous people. And you say, why? What are they doing this for? What's the game?
Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey told WBUR she doesn't pay attention to the president's comments and she supports Rollins and Ryan.
This is about making sure that victims of crime, witnesses to crime, aren't deterred from coming forward. And recent actions by ICE agents have had a disruptive and deterring effect. And that's what the DA's complaint is about. And I support what they're doing in terms of raising this as an issue.
Jennifer, you talked about sort of striking some sort of balance. How do you think we do that?
Well, again, I mean, unfortunately, I think part of the problem here is that you have a president who, you know, is a Republican, and you have district attorneys and the attorney general that are Democrats, right? And so I think, one, politics are at play because he's going to say no to anything that they say, regardless of what they say, sadly. And I think that if this is tried out in a court and we can have it and see, you know, okay, maybe the middle ground is everyone's welcome to come into court. ICE doesn't touch them until the case is all done, and then there can be conversations after that. But I think everyone is entitled to their day in court, and maybe that's a better way to do it. So not saying that ICE shouldn't be able to do its job, but our court system needs to be able to do its job.
And one point that Rollins made is that this is criminal court that we're talking about. An ICE procedure is civil, and that criminal should trump civil.
Right. That's another important balance to strike here. I mean, I think the Attorney General, Maura Healey, is right. It's good policy not to pay too much attention to what the president is saying on this and many other issues.
All right. One more topic for our week in review. The decision by the Massachusetts Gaming Commission to hit Wynn Resorts with a $35 million fine. The company will keep the license for its Encore Boston Harbor Casino in Everett, despite the commission's concern about the company concealing information about sexual harassment allegations against company founder and then CEO Steve Wynn. Gaming Commission Chairwoman Kathy Judd Stein says they were disturbed by the company's culture of nondisclosure.
To help ensure future compliance and indeed to punish for transgressions, the commission has imposed a series of penalties and conditions.
Las Vegas Review-Journal reporter Rick Velotta told us that while it's a record-high fine against the company, it's lower than he expected.
I thought it might be a little bit more, and I think a lot of the people that watch the gaming industry suspected that it could have been higher than that, because there was a sense that, you know, the Massachusetts Gaming Commission meant business on this, and they really were disturbed by some of the things that had happened.
They're also personally fining Wynn's current CEO, Matt Maddox, $500,000. The company still plans to open the $2.6 billion Everett Casino next month. Renee, I mean, this, like I said, billion with a B as opposed to million, these fines. Do you think this is enough?
Well, you know, the house always wins. That's the, the verdict here. It's a pittance. It's real money to some people, like you and me, but it's a pittance for the Wynn Corporation. I noticed that the value of the company, the stock went up in one day on the news that they would be able to keep their license by five times the amount of the fine.
Wow.
And, you know, in one day, the stock went up for that much. So, I mean, you know, this is pocket change for them. It was never realistic to me that they were going to pull the Wynn license. There's just too many facts on the ground. You know, the steel and glass was in. There were thousands of jobs at stake. You know, I think that all they ever really had, you know, in terms of arrows in their quiver were fines and fees that might make a difference. And I'm not sure that these are high enough to make a difference.
Yeah, I mean, just to put a point on that, the Wynn Resorts averaged a total of about $18.4 million in daily revenue last year, according to a securities filing. Jennifer, what do you think
about
that?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Renee. You know, I think that the Gaming Commission was in a really tough spot here because you don't want to take away jobs that people thought that they were going to have over there. And I mean, that's really an economic builder for a good portion of the state, for jobs and ongoing jobs too in that area. So what are they going to do? They're not going to say, okay, you have to pull out completely. But I think $35 million, you know, like Renee said, it's a lot to us, right? I mean, any of us would really appreciate, like, you know, an eighth, a 16th of that.
Right. And it's the biggest, but, it is the biggest fine,
right,
eclipsing the last time that Wynn was fined for the same allegations. But
I think, it could have been more. And maybe there were other penalties going back into the community and regaining some trust and respect in the communities. But I wish it was was more, I'm glad that we got something out of it. I'm glad people still get to have their jobs.
Renee, so looking back into to the bigger picture here, do you think the fact that this casino, it was scheduled to open, I mean, not just that it's these jobs, that it's scheduled to open, that it tied the commissioner's hands?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think not only the jobs, but the tax revenue that the state is already dependent upon. I mean, I think, you know, just to make a much broader point, this is what happens when the state becomes dependent on sin tax revenue, whether it's gambling casino revenue or even the new marijuana law revenue that we're seeing a lot of problems with the rollout of that operation. There's corruption, there's, you know, confusion, there's insider playing going on. And I think that, you know, speaking not as a member of the Republican Party, I would say if we had a broad-based, fair, progressive tax system where people all paid their share, maybe states, not just Massachusetts, but all states, wouldn't be so dependent on these revenues that do tie the hands of commissioners that are trying to roll out these operations in a fair and above board way.
And Jennifer, what does this say about the Gaming Commission? I mean, should people have faith that if their hands were apparently tied by this, that they are an effective check?
Well, I mean, you know, and I do think that they are an effective check. And the men and women on the commission are intelligent and they're upstanding members of the community of business and law. And, you know, so I have a high regard for them. But I do think that, you know, one, yes, Renee is right in the relying on revenues. Two, I mean, you know, unfortunately, while Deval Patrick was governor of Massachusetts, we allowed to have a number of casinos. So it wasn't just one or two. And so I think that that's another problem was, you know, if you give a leash and you keep letting that leash out, you're going to take as much as you can get. And that it was the problem from day one was that too many casinos were allowed to be here, which is tapping and taxing upon what they can do, what the Gaming Commission can do.
All right. Before we run out of time, let's end with our hubbubs, those brief stories or events catching our attention this week. Renee, what do you have?
Well, tomorrow is the birthday of Jane Jacobs, the famed urbanist who, among other things, saved Greenwich Village from the clutches of the developer Robert Moses back in the 60s. And to celebrate her life, people are holding what they're calling Jane's Walks all over the globe. I mean, this is like from Cambridge to Calcutta, where people are just going out. These are free, citizen-led walks of people's neighborhoods where they celebrate, you know, open space and architecture and civic engagement and just the joy of what Jane Jacobs always called the sidewalk ballet. And so I'm urging all our listeners to just get out there tomorrow and walk.
All right, Jennifer.
And mine is another walk. On Sunday morning is Project Bread's Walk for Hunger. And I believe it's 50. Over 20 miles, about 22 miles. And, you know, that is helping our kids who deal with food instability to make sure that families have food and kids are well fed. So when they go to school, they can learn.
All right. Mine is about the Boston Red Sox. They're headed to the White House, or at least some of them are. The trip for the reigning champs was originally scheduled for February, but postponed due to the shutdown. But the real question on Thursday will be who will show up. Chairman Tom Werner will be there. He said of the trip, it's not appropriate for the Red Sox to be either red or blue. Manager Alex Cora told reporters Monday he's not sure. Says, I'll let you guys know when I decide. He said in the past that if he does go, he would want to use that as an opportunity to discuss Puerto Rico with the president. Some players like Chris Sale and Brock Holt said they will be there. Others like Mookie Betts and Jackie Bradley Jr. say they won't. Jennifer Nassor, former chair of the Massachusetts GOP and CEO of Reflect US, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Renee Loft, columnist for the Boston Globe and a contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinion page. It's Friday. I'm going to get it right one day. Thank you as well.
Have a nice weekend.
All right. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Kimberly Atkins, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use. And we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This week, we remember filmmaker John Singleton, who died Monday at the age of 51 after complications from a stroke. Singleton's movies and television gave voice to the Black American experience like few, if none, had done before. He became the youngest director and the first Black person nominated by the Academy Awards for Best Director for his seminal 1991 film, Boys in the Hood.
Turned on the TV this morning. Had to on about living in a violent world. Showed all these foreign places foreigners living on. Started thinking, man. Either they don't know, don't show, I don't care about what's going on in the hood.
Arielle Gray is a producer with The Artery, WBUR's arts and culture team. She writes in a recent column, John Singleton knew, he showed, and he cared. And she joins us now. Arielle, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me, Kimberly.
So I remember seeing Boys in the Hood in a packed theater when it first came out in 1991 and remembering how the genuineness of his storytelling came through in that film. What are your earliest memories of John Singleton and that film?
So, funny story. I was actually born in 91 when Boys in the Hood came out. And I was born to a young Black mother. And so I grew up watching and consuming a lot of the things that she did. And John Singleton's many films were some of those things that I've kind of got from her. So I kind of was watching what she was watching, and my earliest memory is of her being in the living room and Boys in the Hood playing on the television. And she kind of ushered me out of the room with a sense of urgency. And at that time, I didn't understand why. But now as I got older, I realized that it was a very poignant death scene that she didn't want me to see. A death scene now that we still talk about in our culture. And it was one of those films that just became this, I don't know, ubiquitous thing in Black culture. Like, if you hadn't seen Boys in the Hood, then what were you doing?
Yeah. And that scene, it was what one of the teens was shot and killed, and his brother very dramatically brought him home. What do you think it is about Singleton's work that is so compelling, that makes it so different?
I think the thing that was so interesting specifically about Boys in the Hood is that he portrays this neighborhood as kind of being the quintessential American experience. These kids have their parents, they have relationships with each other, they're building friendships, they're involved in their community. And so I think adding that nuance to a place that's usually only portrayed as violent or as ridden with, you know, gang involvement, really showed a different side of the Black experience. It was more than just the trauma and the pain that Black people face. He showed us in all of our happiness, in all of our growth, and also in all of our intelligence. And I think we can really crystallize that essence of his filmmaking in the character of Doughboy, who was played by Ice Cube. And he's kind of portrayed as like this gangster, right? Like, he's riding around the car with his friends. He's calling women a B-word every other sentence. But at his core, Doughboy is actually very intelligent and very perceptive. And he can see all of these things that are happening in his hood. And actually, that first quote that you guys played was him. And that's kind of one of the quotes that ends that film. And I think he was actually probably one of the most compelling characters in Boys in the Hood, precisely because he was such a nuanced character.
And we're talking about Boys in the Hood, but that was John Singleton's first major work, but it certainly wasn't his last. Talk about how his work has changed and how it's affected you.
My childhood was riddled with Singleton's films. And I think
you can really see the difference in his filmmaking, specifically when it comes to the portrayal of Black women, when you look at Boys in the Hood, Poetic Justice, and also Baby Boy. And so he was actually critiqued for his portrayal of Black women and motherhood, specifically in Boys in the Hood. Black mothers were kind of portrayed as being incompetent of raising Black men. And he got some backlash on that. And so with Poetic Justice, and he casted Janet Jackson in that now... and I guess her seminal role, really. Role really kind of kicked off her career as an actress. But she is smart. She's fiery. She's a poet. And actually, the poems that she reads in that movie were written by Maya Angelou. So he offered us a different glimpse into Black womanhood. And he took that criticism and then he adjusted his filmmaking accordingly.
And how do you see the influence in more modern pieces, more modern works he's worked on? He's worked on everything from Too Fast, Too Furious to Empire.
Right. I think it's always so hard to concretely track influence, right? I think he has definitely influenced a wide swath of not just filmmakers, but I think Black creatives in general. He really created a blueprint for other Black filmmakers to follow. As far as using their work to both critique Hollywood while providing us with an in-depth look into the Black experience. And to this day, people still reference his movie. We still have Black girls dressing up as Justice from Poetic Justice every single year. I think that movie single-handedly brought back the box braids.
Yes,
so,
it did.
So that in itself is just a testament to the long-lasting cultural impacts that his work had on our community.
Before we end, I want to play a clip from John Singleton's final interview, which he gave to The Hollywood Reporter last month. Let's listen.
So I'm like that to the executives. Like, you're not going to tell me what my story is. I don't feel there's a lot of people of color in the business that feel comfortable saying it's going to be like this. I don't care what the hell you say. I started when I was 22 years old. So it's like, what the hell can you tell me? It's like, you know, like you said that this wasn't going to work and it worked. And then you said this stuff was going to work and it all worked.
And it's worked. It has worked. I think we can say that he was right. Ariel, how do you want to see the next generation of filmmakers carry on Singleton's legacy into the future?
Yeah, it's funny that you guys just played that quote in a lecture that he gave in 2014. He actually, mirrored what he just said. He said, they ain't letting the Black people tell the stories, which is very true. I think a lot of us in the Black community feel like we don't actually see ourselves portrayed truthfully on screen. And so I see his legacy really being carried out in all of these amazing Black filmmakers who are using their talent to add color to our lives, because so often we're rendered in black and white. And that's what he really tried to avoid doing with his films. We see Jordan Peele creating Black horror, Barry Jenkins portraying, Black queer identity in Moonlight, Ava DuVernay really combining film with activism. And I really think it started all with Singleton's work.
That's Ariel Gray, a producer with The Artery, WBUR's arts and culture team. Ariel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Kimberly Atkins, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Kimberly Atkins. With 21 declared candidates now running for the Democratic nomination for president in 2020, we want to give you a chance to hear from and speak with as many of them as we possibly can. So it only makes sense to start with the first major Democrat to announce a 2020 run. Former Democratic Congressman John Delaney represented Maryland's 6th District from 2013 to 2019. He officially entered the presidential race in July of 2017. 2017, choosing to pursue the White House instead of running for re-election to Congress. And he joins us now in studio. Congressman Delaney, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to Boston.
Thanks for having me, Kimberly.
Listeners, we want to hear from you during this segment. What issues are most important to you in the 2020 election? What questions do you have for the candidates? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or tweet us at Radio Boston. Now, Congressman, I want to start with a bit of today's news. The jobs report that came out, it's pretty positive, according to the figures released by the Labor Department. 263,000 jobs were created in April, which is higher than what was expected. The unemployment rate fell to 3.6%, the lowest it's been in 50 years. Now, the White House, of course, is trumpeting this news as proof that President Trump's economic policies are working. First of all, do you believe that he deserves the credit for the strong economic numbers?
Well, the economic numbers are strong. So, of course, at some level, he and President Obama both deserve the credit. I mean, what influences the economy is a lot of factors, right? I don't think the president's policies that he actually touts are having the impact on the economy that he says. But I do think there's a fair amount of business confidence right now that is causing companies to feel good about hiring, which is based on a whole variety of factors, you know, some of which have been playing out for quite a long time.
And this business confidence, if Americans are happy that that's happened, how do Democrats counter this message from President Trump that the economy is because of him and they should stay the course?
So I think what we have to say is, first of all, we should be happy that we have very good employment numbers, right? Because we want people to have jobs. Jobs are incredibly important. We don't need to talk about the reasons for that, including the fact that they give people dignity and a sense of purpose and self-worth. One of the issues with the data, though, is it doesn't really tell the whole story, because to some extent the problem in the economy right now is not really jobs as much as it's pay. Because a lot of the jobs that are in these jobs numbers really don't pay enough, and it's making it very hard for most Americans to get by. According to the Federal Reserve, who put out this data last year, half of the American people can't afford $500. Mm. So if they wake up and something happens to their house or their car or their health care and it's $500, they don't have the savings or they don't have even the capacity on their credit card.
So,
and that's why so many people have two jobs or three jobs. And so there's a decent number of jobs, but increasingly a lot of the jobs that are getting created have really low pay. Workers don't benefit from the kind of benefits that they really need in many of these situations, and many workers are barely getting by.
So on the issue of income inequality, which is linked to the wage issue that you're talking about, you call yourself a compassionate capitalist. Mm-hmm. How do you square that with how do you square your support for capitalism with this idea that there are these disparities economically in the country?
Well, I think we have to be clear-eyed about what capitalism is. Right. Capitalism creates jobs and it innovates. Right. The free market capitalistic system that this country have is probably the greatest innovation and job creation machine ever created. But if you look back at what we did historically, we had workers' rights. We had great societal infrastructure like good public schools, things like that. We had regulations and we had tax policy that allowed for the benefits of capitalism to be broadly shared. So to some extent, that was the genius of this country. We let capitalism work its magic, but we moderated it. We've really stopped moderating it in the last several, in many ways, decades to some extent. And that's why I think we have such inequality. For example, there's something there's a tax policy out there called the Earned Income Tax Credit. It used to be very bipartisan, right? It's a tax credit that hardworking Americans get, particularly if they're the lower end of the pay scale. You have to work to get it. So it creates an incentive to work. That's something that should have been increased a long time ago, right? Things like that would make a real difference, right, in terms of how the economy is performing today, because we would still see these kind of hopefully good jobs numbers, but we know that the people on the other end of these numbers were actually either getting better pay or better tax breaks.
Now, when I get to the phones, Heidi is calling from Revere. Hi, Heidi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. You're on with Congressman Delaney.
Hi, so I'm a public middle school teacher in Revere, Massachusetts, and I have a question about your stance on the student loan debt crisis. Being an educator, I want to send a positive message about higher education to my students, but feeling like I'm crushed by my loans myself, I want to know just your stance on that and what message I can tell my students about their future.
Thanks for the question, Heidi, and thanks for what you do, which is to educate the next generation of young people. I really admire that. And you all are under a lot of pressure these days because your job's gotten a lot tougher because public school teachers are asked to do a lot more than they have historically. You know, Heidi, there's a couple of issues. One, I think the rates on student loans are too high. Right now, the federal government makes a lot of money on student lending. And what I'd like to do is lower the rates so that the federal government breaks even on it. So that's one thing I think we need to do. The other thing I think we need to do is we need to have more programs that tie your repayment to your income. Right. So if you become a public school teacher or a school teacher and you have lower income than a software programmer in Silicon Valley, your payments will inherently be lower because it'll be tied to a percentage of your earnings. I think that's something we should do. I think we have to do things to make community college part of public education, meaning free. Either that or career and technical training, I think, should be part of public education. And that would alleviate the burden even for those kids who want to pursue a four-year degree because they could do 2 years of community college at no cost and then go to another 2 years to a four-year college. And if their student loan rates were lower, that would make education a lot more affordable.
Now, Senator Elizabeth Warren, a fellow 2020 candidate, is proposing debt forgiveness tied to income. What do you think of that proposal?
Well, I think – you know, the way I would do it is by having more refinance programs. First of all, there's two types of debts. There's private student debt and then there's public student debt, right? Private student debt, the federal government has really no ability to do anything with it because it's held privately. What the federal government can do is create refinancing programs that allow students to refinance into federal loans at lower rates and at more attractive repayment programs like what I just talked about. So that's what I'm in favor of because I think that'll impact positively more kids.
All right. Galen is calling from Newton. Hi, Galen.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. It's great to hear you, Congressman Delaney.
Thanks, Galen.
I was wondering what your thoughts are and whether you have a stance on what Democrats should do to energize voters similarly to what Republicans did in 2016 when it came to the Supreme Court. I've heard several candidates talk about the possibility of announcing a slate of candidates preemptively, like who we would nominate. Do you think that's an effective strategy? It's one of my top concerns going forward, certainly, given how long they're on the bench.
Yeah, no, I think – and listen, I think people like myself think these Supreme Court justices shouldn't be – on the bench for as long as they are. I think we should have some term limits for these people because it's made this appointment to the Supreme Court kind of a 40-year appointment, which makes it a lot more consequential than it should be. I would be in favor of things like 18-year terms for Supreme Court justices. You know, the president announced a slate of potential Supreme Court appointees, and that did get Republicans energized. So it worked for him. The problem is it's very hard to say, okay, who you're going to appoint to the court 2, 3, 4 years from now. I think what's important is that our nominees make it very clear the type of people we're going to appoint. It's got to be people who want to actually protect people, right, and are in favor of people as opposed to corporations. I think we ought to make it very clear that we're going to appoint people who are going to protect some of the rights that we fought so hard for in the last several decades. You know, things like marriage equality, and you can go down the list. So I think it's my preference, rather than putting a list of individuals, is actually to talk about the type of people that I would appoint to the court. But I also think we should have a discussion about whether these terms should be lifetime appointments. But the other point to make that I do think is relevant is in many ways we've allowed the Supreme Court to become way too important in this country. And what I mean by that is because Congress is so dysfunctional, too many things are being decided by the Supreme Court and through executive authority. Meaning our broken Congress has created a situation that presidents with executive authority try to effectively legislate. And the court is asked to confront a lot of questions they shouldn't be dealing with. For example, the court was asked to decide whether carbon is actually or greenhouse gases are things that can be regulated under the Clean Air Act.
Right.
That shouldn't be a question for the Supreme Court. That should be decided by legislation, meaning we should pass laws that deal with climate change and global warming, as opposed to effectively abdicating these responsibilities, which is why one of the reasons a big part of my candidacy is actually getting our government working again. Mm-hmm. Because our government is so broken, we've effectively put ourselves in a position where a combination of the executive branch and the court are actually doing the legislating in this country.
I also want to remind our listeners that they can call in and talk with John Delaney, 2020 Democratic candidate, at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I want to talk about health care.
Sure.
When I'm talking to voters, that's usually one of the first
top
words
issue
that they say. More Democrats have started to embrace Medicare for all, including Senator Bernie Sanders. And I know that's not something that you support. How do you deal with rising health care costs, inadequate coverage, lack of access to treatment without Medicare for All?
So I think Medicare for All, that specific bill, because when people say Medicare for All, what they're referring to is a specific piece of legislation. I actually think that piece of legislation will make access to health care more limited and won't do anything to control health care costs and in many ways may reduce quality. I am for universal health care. In other words, I am for every single American having health care as a basic right of citizenship. I think it's a basic human right. I think in 2019, when you consider how advanced we are as a society and a world, everyone should have health care as a right. I also think it's smart economic policy. I mean, I think it's crazy that so many Americans are shackled to their job because of their health care. They may want to get a better job or start a business or do these things. But I just think this notion that the government should be the only payer of health care would actually result in worse health care. And I'll tell you why I believe that is because if you look at the data right now, Medicaid, which is the largest health care program in this country, only pays 80% of cost. So, if Kimberly, if you and I were running a hospital and we only took Medicaid, we'd lose 20%, which means we'd close. Medicare only pays 95% of cost, and commercial insurance pays about 115% or 120% of cost. So there's no evidence to suggest that if the government was the only payer that it would ever pay cost, and that would result in more limited access. And just to make the point, when I go around rural America, I always visit a rural hospital, and I always ask the administrator, if last year all of your commercial insurance bills were paid by Medicare, what would happen? And they all say the same thing. We would close. So my point there is we should have universal health care as a right, and I have a plan
sure
to do it. But it should be a mixed model where people can also get supplementals or buy additional private options. That will lead to a healthier health care marketplace.
And just to get to the point, I want to get to more callers in the short time we have left. But you also say health insurance should not be tied to employment. But how do you accomplish that? I mean, I had to sign up to the federal health care exchange at some point for several years, and I stopped going to the doctor because it was so expensive.
Yeah.
How do you accomplish that?
So the way I would do it is I would give everyone a basic health care package as a right. Right? You'd get that from when you're born to when you're 65. When you're over 65, you go to Medicare. It's your basic plan, and it would have minimum benefits similar to what's in the Affordable Care Act, and your co-pays would be tied to your income, so it'd be means tested. But then individuals would have options. They could buy supplemental plans, just like Medicare beneficiaries do. So you'd end up with this kind of mixed model healthcare where everyone has a basic government plan, so they're always covered, right? And if they're low income, they don't have copays. If they have higher incomes, they do. And then they can actually go and buy additional options in the market.
All right. Joe is calling from Westwood. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Quick question I'd like some comment on, which is there's now 21 candidates on the Democratic side. And for most Democrats, the main goal is making sure that the election is won by a Democrat. Let's be honest here.
Yep.
And so what I'd like a comment or thoughts on what's going to happen to prevent those 21 candidates from essentially killing any possibility for a Democrat winning the presidential race in 2020, which is partly what happened in 2016 that resulted with Trump being in office. And is there any potential for the current running candidates to get together as a group and decide we don't want to do that. We want to choose the front leader amongst us and avoid that problem.
Joe,
thank you
for that question. I mean, there's 21. There could be a few more that get in.
Yeah. So, Joe, I think we need a real debate of ideas. I don't think it should be a very negative campaign. I don't think we should be attacking each other. I don't attack anyone. I tell people what I'm going to do for them and what my ideas are because I got a lot of new ideas. And that's what we really need. In many ways, what we had in 2016 was the opposite of that. We didn't have a big field. We didn't have a real debate. I think most Democrats settled very quickly either in Secretary Clinton's camp or Senator Sanders's camp, right? And so I'm actually for kind of the opposite of that, which is you, the voters, I'm assuming you're a Democratic voter, you should hear all of our ideas and you should make the decision about who's got the best ideas. That's the best way for us to put up the person who will beat Donald Trump. Because I agree with you, the most important thing by any measure, is for Democrats to win in 2020.
Now, just one more question about the minute we have left. You said that only a moderate on the Democratic side can beat Donald Trump. Why do you think that?
Because I think President Trump is going to turn out his voters in huge numbers, and I think Democrats are going to turn out in huge numbers. We saw that in the midterms in 2018. In 435 districts around this country, whether the person was a socialist or a moderate, whether they were young or older, whether they were white or a person of color, woman, man, straight, gay, no matter what, we ran this amazingly diverse field of candidates all across the country, and we saw record turnout. And so I believe in 2020, no matter which one of the 20 of us who are running have the privilege of having the nomination, I think Democrats are energized and will turn out. And I think President Trump's going to turn out his voters. So that tells me this election's going to be fought in the center.
That's former Maryland Congressman and 2020 Democratic primary candidate John Delaney. Congressman Delaney, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Kimberly.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Kimberly Atkins. Join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.